Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, special guest host Dr. Johnny Rees, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, we speak to the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. Nick is the CEO of Renaissance Periodization. He's an IFBB pro. He's the author of Fit for Success. He's got a lot of other achievements as well. But Nick, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
No, great, man. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
No, well, I'm really excited to dig in. So I guess the first question, I'd love if you could just talk a little bit about kind of growing up and your childhood and some of the stories that you have there, I think are very insightful into the man you are today. So yeah, run us through kind of growing up all the way up to college. Let's start.
Yeah, I grew up in rural Michigan. And I think growing up in Michigan is important because from a pretty early age, I knew slash thought I wanted to go to the University of Michigan. I grew up, my family was Michigan football fans, and I was a big sports fan, and I just always watched it and liked it and was like, you know what? It happens to be a really great school too. Like, I want to go there someday. Like, that's my goal. And Michigan's a really good school. And so it definitely was a challenge to like do well in school, do pretty good on like the standardized tests in order to get in. And the only reason I say that is because like I've been pretty goal oriented, goal focused most of my life. And you know, like that was a big goal of mine. And I did as much as I possibly could to ensure that I was going to hit that. And I actually went and met with a state representative, in a town about 30 minutes from where I'm from, and went in, sat down with him, and I was like, I know you were like the head of the alumni association. I want you to let you know, like, this has been a goal and a dream of mine since I was a kid. And like, look at my grades. I'm in like, you know, the top couple in my grade. I got decent standardized test score, nothing amazing. I don't know if I would get in today, actually, which is funny because, you know, now I have quite a bit to do with Michigan.
Early achievement award and all that stuff, right? And yeah.
Yeah, totally, man. And some cool scholarships and whatnot that we have set up. Just really cool stuff. But yeah, it's just funny. You know, thankfully I did that. And, you know, thankfully they took a chance on me because it certainly was a risk on their part. Because without that, would I have gotten in? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, I didn't have like amazing test scores. I had decent. But like my GPA was up there and you all that and just said like, hey, I love sports. I want to go to school for sport management. I want to maybe be an athletic director when I'm done. And so that's kind of how I set out. It's like, I was one of the first people in my entire grade, my senior year, to know where they were going to college. Like I accepted super early. And so by like the fall, like I knew I was going to Michigan, you know, huge sports fan growing up, into playing sports and whatnot. We didn't have a good football program at my high school, so that was never really an option because I was like, I don't know. I don't want to go out there and get my butt kicked if we're not even going to do well. And I ended up being a runner. And so, again, I think that was pretty valuable insight for me growing up because it just led me to figure out that if you just work your ass off, you're probably going to do pretty well. Like I definitely wasn't gifted with athletic genes or anything like that, but maybe my genes, my talent was – kind of just being somewhat psychotic when it came to working out and being able to push myself. And well, you combine that with being goal focused and well, you know, you can turn out to be decent in high school sports and probably led to me being a bodybuilder because, you know, bodybuilding is really hard. Arguably I'm making air quotes here, the hardest sport in the world. And not that it necessarily requires amazing genetics, probably requires pretty decent genetics, but and the dedication, discipline, and all that goal setting definitely has to be there if you want to be pretty good at that. So, yeah, here I am as a fitness entrepreneur.
But, I mean, there's a lot in that. So, for example, there was one story that you mentioned before, but about kind of being very goal-orientated and early on having a good kind of realizing that you were going to have to do things, you know, perhaps that others wouldn't to get the result that others can't. So there's an example you give about running 100 miles over the summer
I think maybe like your freshman year of high school or sophomore or something like that. Running, if you could kind of tell that story, because that's a great illustration. If you could tell that story, that would be great.
Yeah, there's nine in my freshman year. There's nine people on our cross country team. Only the top seven like could compete on a varsity, and I was eighth. I wasn't even in the top seven. And then our track coach was the same as our cross country coach, and so we get down a track in the spring. And so you've got like what, May, June, July, a little bit of August, like get ready for the next season. And he's like, guys, your goals are 100 miles. You just got to put in the miles. And well, like he told me to do it. And hey, guess what? I'm goal focused. So all right, I was going to run 100 miles. I like logged how much I ran every single day on my calendar. And like, of course, and I probably did over that. I don't remember the exact amount. But then the first day of practice, this would have been my sophomore year now. You know, we go on like, I don't know, 3-4 mile run. And I went from, you know, eighth the year before to now I was up running with like the top 2-3 guys. And so I just remember them asking me and they're like, Shaw, what'd you do? Shaw, how'd you get so good? And I was like, what do you mean? Well, there was only like two, maybe three people on the whole entire team that had actually run 100 miles. And to me, I was like, oh, light bulb going off. Okay. If I just do this, then I've got a chance. Cause again, like, do I have any special athletic ability? No, not really. But guess what? I just did what I was asked and not everyone did. So I got up above him. And I remember the one guy, he was one of our best runners. You know, he was like, dude, how'd you get 6-pack abs? And I was like, I didn't know what I was doing back then. So let me just preface that. I was like, dude, I just did like hundreds of sit-ups every night. Like that's what I did. I didn't know any better. The only thing I knew was just how to work hard. And so, you know, at that age, you know, not that many kids are willing to do that. And so, you know, I did all right. And so like, again, that to me was just like, man, fitness is where it's at, because you know, fitness is such a cool thing. And like the hard work you put in, you very, I don't want to say quickly, but it's very evident what you get out on the other end. You insert input A, you get out output B. And to me, that was really cool because I was like, all right, well, I'll just keep putting in more A and I'll get more out B, right? Now, obviously, we know as I got older and learned more, there's a little bit more to it than that. But, you know, at 15 years old, like that's not a bad thing to learn.
Yeah. And I think that served you very well, you know, going forward, right? Those early lessons, I think, are still evident today, right? So I guess my next question is, so we're at, or you're at the University of Michigan now, right? And you were going to kind of walk on as a cross country runner, right? But then you were doing other stuff. So I think the story about how you first met Mike, that's Dr. Mike Israetel for those, who don't know, who is the other, he's the co-founder, right?
Yeah. I was going to try to walk on the track team. I wasn't nearly good enough for cross country because I was too big. I love lifting. So when I was a cross country runner, I was like 20 pounds heavier than everyone else. Mike and I were just making this joke the other day on the phone. And I was like, yeah, I remember back in the day, like everyone's, you know, a little skinny 130 pound cross country runner. And here I am at like 160, you're probably the only kid that can bench 225 because I love to lift, but I also love to work out. So it was like, I wasn't great at long distance and I wasn't a great sprinter, but you put me in those mid distance events. Again, what do most people not like? They don't like those mid distance events because they hurt. And they just require just a disgusting mindset where you just want to push yourself and get after it. And I was like, all right, well, I got no talent. Sign me up for those and I'll do them. And so it just kind of fit my personality. But yeah, that coach pretty quickly told me, he's like, dude, you're nothing special. Like, I don't even know if there's a spot for you to walk on. You know, he was very honest. And I was like, all right, respect. And I was like, I guess I'll do something else. And whatever. I still ran a little bit my freshman year. And then sophomore year, I was always going to the gym and always working out. Didn't really have a set program or anything like that. But yeah, that's where I ended up meeting Mike in the Michigan weight room. And, you know, he was lifting some crazy weights. I was doing some crazy stuff. You know, not that many people in a student weight room are doing that. So we just hit it off. And he's like, hey, like you should compete in the Michigan Powerlifting Club, of which he had started. And I had that competitive streak in me, you know, I went from like running and I enjoyed that, you know, that like get really anxious in your stomach. You got those nerves going. And I was like, all right, that sounds kind of cool. Like, I'm interested in it. And that's, yeah, I did a first ever meet. Mike kind of coached me through it. And then I started training with him full time after that. And that was really like, if you want to go, March 2007 is when like that true foundation for RP was really laid.
That's really interesting. And you've actually competed in quite a few sports, right? Because it was only maybe 2008 that you first competed in bodybuilding, right? So a year later.
Yeah. March of 2007, I competed in a powerlifting meet, first one I ever did in the 181 weight class. And then, yeah, fast forward like a year or so, I competed in a bodybuilding show as a middleweight, and you know, I got my ass kicked.
But yeah, I mean, amazing lessons though, right? And even just to step on stage and not look like I'm like a fool, it's still, that's, you know, that's a pretty high bar. That's a pretty high level, even at that kind of.
Yeah, know, not bad for, I don't even know how old I was, 20? Yeah, I was 20 years old.
Exactly. And you've also competed, right, in CrossFit. You've done all sorts of stuff. I noticed that, you know, there's a pretty varied
background. I've dabbled in those. I've not actually competed, but I've trained. I trained jiu-jitsu, got my blue belt, trained CrossFit, where, like, I could show up on any given day and do Murph, just, you know, so I could say, like, hey, I'm in good enough shape to do that. Just some different things like that.
I think that's probably helpful as well, because it helps you. I know you've coached all sorts of people from, you know, CrossFit to, you know, elite athletes in almost every walk of life, right? So I think probably having an understanding of what they're going through, even if you didn't weren't at that level, was got to be invaluable, right?
That's exactly what I did. I was like, we're working with a ton of CrossFitters. I got to be able to know some of the lingo and be able to, like, not hold my own against those guys because they're so good, but not embarrass myself. Like, I could go and then any day kind of, you know, rip out a decent workout.
Yeah. Certainly gives you more credibility as well, right?
100%, and I think 100%. Yep.
That's one of the things that I find very impressive about RP, is the fact that you have guys who are sort of, and obviously women who are, you know, PhD educated, but also amazing athletes themselves, right? So I think that's really testament to RP and the sort of services you're able to offer.
Yeah. That was really the core reason for starting RP, is combining those two sort of disciplines, high-end athletics, but also the elite academics. And if you combine both of those into one, you have something that's pretty unbeatable, because a lot of times you only have one or the other. And it's easy to poke holes in those people's arguments and not take them as seriously. But when you get to that, like, next level and you can combine both, evidence-based on the academic side, and it's basically walk the walk, talk the talk. And if you do that, man, you're really on to something.
Yeah, hard to argue with that. So totally. I guess thinking about RP now, right? So it started around 2011, is that right?
Yeah, something like that. The official date. So it was a little hazy, like, what do we technically count as the official date and all that? But yeah, something like that, man. It's like over 12 years now.
Yeah, that's and there have been certain kind of, I've heard you talk about this, certain sort of inflection points, I guess, where growth has suddenly increased. So I think you talked about, you know, the templates, the ebooks in about 2014, the templates, and then the apps in 2019, and then, you know, YouTube kind of taking off around COVID or just after. I was wondering if you kind of talk about that a little bit and the sort of lessons you've learned there, because you're very good at adapting and kind of pivoting. And I know, for example, that Instagram used to be really big on, like, transformation before and after, and then it suddenly, like, really didn't like that. And that was obviously a big part of your business, right? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I'd say there's, like, three main inflection points. Maybe more, but let's just stick with three. The first one was, we were just coaching a lot of people, and then we took that and sort of synthesized it down into an ebook in October of 2014. That allowed us to start scaling that. Opened up our eyes to, whoa, now we're on to something. That's pretty cool. And so then that led to inflection point number two of, well, let's try to scale coaching people on nutrition side of things. We did that. We created the digital diet templates, which were just Excel files at first, which later became PDFs. And that was really so that's the second inflection point where we said, oh, now we got something. Now we can really scale this. And so we started using more automations and stuff on the back end to help do that, because, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you go from selling 5 or 10 a day to, you know, 100 plus a day. Like, you just can't do that manually. So it required that work. And again, you know, there's many, many inflection points, but we want to get to then, like, the third one. It's almost like different growth inflection points, really. Because it went from the ebooks to the templates to, well, then we created an app because we were self-funding the whole time to build up the app. But it really was like when we noticed that we had a chance to do something pretty special on YouTube, and really kind of commit and double down on that, that then that's led to some really crazy growth here, like the last, you know, call it year or so. So that, those are kind of those three main inflection points for me along the way with RP.
Yeah, that's, it's really interesting to see. I mean, could you have imagined 10 years ago kind of where, were you sort of, were these in the projections and, you know?
Absolutely not, man. 10 years ago, you know, we didn't even have an ebook. So if you'd have told me, like, it was Mike and I and maybe a couple other people and we were just coaching folks, we'd have been like, hey, that's pretty cool. Because it's just what we love to do, right? It's like the difference between a job, a career, and a calling. And again, Mike and I were literally just chatting about this. So today's Monday, yesterday morning a little bit. And I was like, you know, what's an example of someone's calling? Well, it's like him and I doing fitness stuff. It was a no-brainer. That's what we were always going to do. Now, the exact end outcome, not super clear, but it would have just been something in the fitness field. We'd have been totally fine, you know, being someone like, you know, John Meadows, right? Rest in peace. A great, fantastic guy. But, you know, for the most part, he just coached people. And there's nothing wrong with that. He had some other stuff going on too, of course. And, you know, later started some supplement companies and whatnot. But, you know, it's like a trajectory like that would have been totally cool with. Like, hey, that's really cool. Because we would have been really involved in it. But we just realized that kind of what we had going on, there's probably a way that we could scale it out and help more people, which is, you know, the cool part. Because that's what YouTube's doing now. I mean, just the numbers are mind-blowing. I mean, it's literally a couple million people a day are watching the YouTube channel. So it's wild.
Yeah, that's nuts when you think about it, especially like there can't be many fitness and health channels that get those kind of numbers.
The YouTube channel might be one of the top couple fitness channels in the entire world right now, which is it's really something, man, because you're like, how do you really make an impact? How do you help people? That's a pretty good way right there.
And I think it's a great kind of combination between you and Mike, because I remember there's a story, and I can really relate to this as an academic part of the time, where I think you saw him giving a lecture. And, you know, a lot of people in lectures, I see it, you know, people are kind of switching off, or they're kind of like, you know, not struggling to stay awake. That's harsh, but like they're not as engaged as they might be. And then you saw him and they were like all having a great time. And you were thinking, well, hang on, if you can do this with 20 people, why couldn't he do this with, as you said, like a huge, huge numbers?
April of 2014, I went to visit him, and Jared Feather was one of his students at the time. And I sat in on a couple of his classes at the University of Central Missouri. And yeah, you know, there's, I don't know, 30 kids in the class. And I just remember looking around and they're all laughing and joking and Mike's making jokes and all that. And I was just like, man, like I never really had this when I was in college. That's not what it was like. I'm trying to, you know, I had a couple of professors that I really liked, but even then they weren't as engaging as Mike, because Mike's just got the gift of the gab. He just has it. Not everyone does, but he has it. And so it's like, it's being wasted if you're only using that to 20, 30 people at a time. And I mean that with all due respect, right, to academics. But if you have the possibility to then go help and influence, impact millions of people a day, when you got the gift, you got to use it.
Totally, yeah. So kind of segueing a little bit, listening to all of this, people are thinking, oh, you know, it's been very much kind of smooth sailing. You know, you've done very well. You've had these sort of huge inflection points with the growth and that sort of stuff. But it hasn't quite been as straightforward as that. And I'm referring to like your mindset type stuff. And I mean, one of the things from your book, so Fit for Success, which I'd recommend to a lot of people, I thought was excellent.
Thank you.
But one of the things that I found really useful was you talking about this internal locus of control and kind of taking back control and, you know, controlling what you can control, not being a victim. And there's a very, I've referred to things not being smooth sailing because, you know, your wife in 2020 was diagnosed with quite a nasty form of, well, not that there's one that isn't nasty, but an aggressive form of breast cancer, right?
Yep.
So there's a story you tell in the book about internal locus of control and, you know, her cancer. I was wondering if you could tell that now, because I think that's really persuasive and really illustrative.
Totally. Yeah. Let me preface this by something that I basically tell myself every single day is there's always something I can do. There's always something you can do. There's always something you can do. Never a victim, never a bystander. There's always something you can do. And that goes back to internal locus of control. And the idea of that's kind of the difference between hope and optimism. Optimism is like, and I'm both. I'm an optimistic person, of course, because like I think things are always going to get better. But I'm hopeful because I know that what I say, what I think, and what I do does matter and will impact my future outcomes. So there's always something that I can do around it. So like that's why I'm hopeful. And the reason I can just rattle that off so quick and easy is because I've said that to myself a million times. So it becomes second nature. But so my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer in January of 2020, like a week before my son's 8th birthday. He's 12 now, by the way. So that's, you know, awesome. And my wife's 99.9% back to normal. So, you know, it's, you know, happy ending here, right? So just want to preface those a couple things. And, you know, she ended up having to have surgery. And there were some complications. She was like stuck in the hospital for a couple of days. Just nasty stuff, right? When you've got an 8 and a 6-year-old at home. Well, I guess my daughter was 5 at the time. She hadn't yet turned 6.
All during COVID as well. And, so like things are tougher with that.
Yep. Yes. The surgery was before the quarantine and all that stuff where the world shut down because that was March. And I remember because I went with my wife to her first ever chemo treatment. And the thing that stands out to me about that is I'm sitting there and I'm like watching this older couple. And I forget whether it was the wife or the husband that was going through the treatment, but they were just like complaining the whole time. Like nothing was good enough. Like just, I'm like, man, what a wild mindset to have. And, you know, like I had brought tons of books. Like Lori had brought tons of stuff. We were just like, you know what? Like, yeah, this sucks. Right. But we can still make some good out of it. Like we're going to be sitting here for a while. We might as well do something. And so that was the first treatment I was able to go with her. And then after that, the world shut down, COVID hit. And, you know, my wife was going to lose her hair. And so we were like, all right. So she told me, she's like, I don't want it to fall out. Like that's going to be really crazy with the kids around. Like I don't want them to see that. And so we proactively got ahead of it and we all shaved our heads together. So I got to shave my wife's head, which, you know, Not everyone can say that. Yeah, I did my own, but you know, to me, I got pretty short hair anyway, so it doesn't really matter. You know, my son, he loved it, and like, I don't remember if my daughter was. I think she was still in school. I don't think they had been sent home yet. But like, I'm not going to send my 6-year-old daughter to school with a shaved head, right? Like, she's 6. I don't want to do that to her. So we just did this like little strip along the side of her head. And it fundamentally changed everything because we were no longer victims. It's like, oh, we're victims of cancer now. It's like, nope, we're in charge. We've got a say over this. So never a victim, never a bystander. There's always something we can do. So what are we going to do? We're going to say, we're going to speak things. We're going to be more grateful. We're going to think, right? We're going to think differently. We're going to get ahead of this. Then there's always something you can do, right? Do something, you know, with your hands or whatever. Well, that's how we get it. So we provided those three things. That's the difference between internal and external locus of control. Internal locus of control, you're dictating things. External, you're just setting back. Things are just happening to you. You don't have any say over it. Well, what happens when you got people like that? It's a negative downward spiral because there's nothing you can do. You become helpless. Like, I refuse to be helpless. I will never be helpless my entire life. I don't care what happens to me. Like, I can always, as long as I have my mind, I'm good.
Yeah. And I mean, that's so many useful lessons there and so many insightful lessons. And I would encourage people to read the book as well, because one thing I noticed with that is that it's a sort of synthesis, it's a sort of aggregate or literature review of so many useful books with kind of actionable takeaways and really, I say anecdotes and that has a sort of pejorative connotation, but like illustrative stories behind it that, you know, I found that really useful as a guy who reads a lot and who reads, you know, a lot of that type of literature. So
yeah, like I just started reading all the, you know, the popular books and like self-help genre, psychology, personal finances, you know, whatever it is, leadership, all that stuff. And you just start noticing all these common themes. You're like, oh, okay, now I can tell why people are successful. Well, it's because they share a lot of common things. And then I was like, well, rather than someone going and reading, I don't know, these 50 to 100 books, like, I can just kind of break it down into like, what are the key main patterns that are existing between all these things? Like, that's what I love. I love looking for those patterns and different things. So like, that's how I learn. So when a couple of years ago, you know, actually not a couple of years ago, literally just a little over a year ago, I was like, I gotta learn marketing better. So I started out, I'm like, I took a bunch of different courses. I read a few different books and then I started synthesizing the top three to four things that every single person was saying. And I was like, oh, okay, so this is where you start. Okay, this is how you go about it. All right, that makes a lot of sense. So for me, like, I have to look for those patterns and put it all together. That's just how I learn. And really, anytime I want to start learning stuff, like, that's how I have to go about it.
And I think that's really useful, because finding those areas of commonality among all sorts of different books is really helpful, I think, because if they've all said it, then, you know, chances are that's going to be an effective kind of...
There's probably something to it, yeah.
Yeah, there's consensus like that. So I think that systematic way of analyzing and implementing as well. One of the things that I thought was really good was the implementation as well. You know, so many people will read things and just accumulate knowledge, but then it's only as good as what you apply, really, right?
Yeah. Whenever I read a book, I try to end with, like, what's one thing? What's one thing? What's one takeaway I can get from this book, even if it's something minor? And, like, and sometimes you read a book and it's like, well, this just kind of reaffirmed this. Like, okay, well, that's not a net negative. That's still a positive. But usually I'm always like, all right, what is the key takeaway from this? Or, like, what is one action item I can do right away? And because, yeah, like, reading and learning just to learn is cool and it's fun. But I want to actually use this stuff. Like, I don't want to just read this and then do nothing with it. Like, that doesn't really seem to make a whole lot of sense. And
especially not with those kind of books as well, right? They're not really they're designed to be implemented rather than...
I would hope so. Yeah. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
I think, yeah, that's really... So, again, thinking about these sort of areas of... You're very consistent and considered. And one of the things that you talk about is this slight edge principle. Now, I realize it's from a book and it's not original to you, but there are a lot of lessons from fitness that can be applied to finances and vice versa. You know, almost the idea of compound interest and just doing these small things very well every day will add up. And I think you're an excellent example of, you know, that manifested and shown just how effective that is. But reminds me a lot of, I did my PhD in sort of performance enhancement type stuff in sport. And this idea of marginal gains, Team Sky, that won a lot of medals in cycling. So I suppose my question is, how do you remain so consistent? How do you sort of, because a lot of people will struggle with that. They can be very good for a few days in a row, but how do you kind of keep this ruthless consistency that is obviously key to success? But how do you maintain that?
It's so deeply ingrained in me now that it's just part of, like, my identity. It's just part of who I am. And again, you know, there's a reason that earlier I could just rattle off those few sentences about that, because I just literally tell myself that every single day. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I don't know, 5 years ago, that wouldn't necessarily have been the case. Like, yeah, there were some, yeah, I had bits and pieces and all that. But I just really, like, set about, I'm like, all right, so what are some little things I can do every single day? All right, cool. Let's just start checking them off. Part of it is you just basically you're telling yourself, not just listening to yourself, telling yourself, well, now I've told myself these things a million times. It's just ingrained in my psychology. I can't really do anything any other way. It's all I know, which, like, could maybe be bad if it was something bad, but I don't think it is bad, because, like, I like to study and learn, like, what successful people do for fun, and I'm pretty confident in this. And you listen to enough people and they all kind of say the same things over time. It's like, no one becomes successful overnight. You take the sporting examples for sure. Like, how do you do it in fitness? Well, I don't know. Like, I want to be in shape and I want to be healthy and I want to be lean. All right. Well, guess what? I got to eat 4, 5, 6 healthy meals a day. Well, that doesn't seem like much today, but now you do that for 5, 10 years. Now you're fundamentally a different person. So, man, I don't know. And I think it comes easier to some people, and some people just don't get it because some people just don't want to do the work. And it's like, that's fine. I'm not here to diss on other people, but, like, I want to be great. I don't want to be average. I want to stand out. I don't want to just sink into the crowd. And so in order to do that, it just requires doing a lot of things that other people are just not willing to do. All right, fine. Like, I'm willing to do them.
Yeah, that's, and I think, just in fairness, you know, there's this idea of constantly improving every day. But in the book, you also have a chapter, I think it's called Recharge or something like that. So obviously there's going to be a balance, right? Because it sounds like you and I would be similar to this. always on this pursuit of improvement, right? But at some point, you know, you can't just be pedal to the metal all the time, right? So there is this, and you'll actually, it's almost like deloading in training, right? There's almost going to be benefits from backing off a little bit, because then you're sort of, I was going to say your psychology heals, but that sounds a bit over the top. But like your
kind of
your psyche kind of is ready to go again, right?
Totally. Well, it's like how much, like let's say you were like, all right, I'm going to spend the next 12 hours reading. How much of that is actually productive work? Like you're going to have a couple hours. You're better off like getting after it for an hour or two, taking a break, going for a walk, doing something, kind of recharging your batteries a little bit, and then maybe coming back to it later. So you, then even when I was in college, I didn't get amazing grades in college. Like I graduated like a 3.3, 3.4 GPA, like whatever. But I was never one to pull an all-nighter. I knew from an early age, I'm like, you know what? If I don't know it by now, I'm going to study a little bit and then I'm just going to go to sleep. I'd rather take those extra couple hours, get some sleep, show up, maybe be in a better mood-ish, go in just thinking that I know it then. Because I'm like, yeah, I got some sleep. Yeah, I feel good. Yeah, okay. Well, I'll take my chances versus like cramming and trying to do all that, because it's like the marginal returns there, it's just not worth it. Like I just never understood that mindset. I'm like, well, what are you going to do? Like, what are you going to cram last minute? Like how much knowledge are you actually going to put in your brain? Like not. And then even if you do, like you're certainly not remembering that stuff. You'll remember for those couple hours, then it's gone.
Yeah. And I think there are good sort of parallels with training there, right? Like people who train, you know, the last kind of couple of weeks for an event, you got to sort of think, well, the hay's in the barn at that point, right? I'm not going to be doing, if you're not lean enough 2 weeks out, you're probably not lean enough or whatever it might be.
Well, I'll do a side tangent on that, because so when I was going to compete at the show I did last summer, originally I was going to do one that was 3 weeks later, but about a month out, I got, you know, permission from my coach, Jared Feather, RP coach, and one of my colleagues. He's like, yeah, I think you've got a shot. And it does go back to that, like you're able to push yourself for a certain amount of time. And so, man, I put the pedal to the metal because I knew I only had a few weeks to do it. And then like the week of, you would ease back, you would ease into it, reduce that stress, just relax, relax, relax. So I knew, man, those couple weeks before, I'm talking, you know, 15 to 20,000 steps every single day, you know, something probably under 2,000 calories a day, training six times a week with weights. But again, I knew it was a short-term thing. Like I couldn't sustain that beyond that. But given the timeline and given like, hey, I actually want to give this a serious shot, I was totally fine just putting that hammer down and just getting after it.
And having a goal like that, you know, very much a time phase goal like totally. That is going to concentrate the mind, I think. So you've sort of mentioned it there, and segueing a little bit onto nutrition, because I know that, you know, that's one of the major things you do at mm-hmm. RP, right? In addition to, I know you have the app for training, but you have the RP nutrition app as well, right? RP diet. So I was wondering if you could kind of maybe explain or maybe detail what you think are the biggest sort of mistakes you see people making in the context of nutrition.
Yeah. Number one is the idea of consistency over perfection. So when people get started, they think that they have to be perfect. It really all comes down to the all or nothing mentality. And they're like, oh, I'm either all in or like, I'm not doing it at all. You're like, okay, well, it's an interesting way to phrase it. And listen, I get it, right? Because when you got that goal, you're doing a cut phase, you're doing it for just 8, 12, you know, whatever number of weeks. It's easy to kind of just be all in. You're like, yep, nope, I'm not going off track. Nope, nope, nope. And it's easy to get those blinders on. But then you get something like maintenance after, and it's easy when those goals kind of step back and you're like, I don't know what to do now. I almost feel a little lost. Listen, I've been there. So you just realize like, yeah, I might slide off the rails a little bit here or there, but guess what? 85, 90% over the long term is a heck of a lot better than 100% for a couple of weeks. And then you backslide and, you know, you have one event out with your friends and, you know, you eat some bad food and they're like, oh my gosh, this is terrible. And then a lot of people just never get back on track at all. And it's like, why? It's just, there's a great quote. We had I met him in person actually. So he's a pilot. And one time he was coming to the Charlotte airport and believe it or not, I was flying out that same day. So I actually went to the airport a little early and I met him because he was on the RP podcast before. He was like one of our top transformation people. But he had a great quote, and so I sort of stuck with me. It's like, you're never more than one meal or one workout away from being right back on track.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. And also thinking about one meal in the context of, say you're eating four meals a day, five meals a day, right? A week, 30 plus meals a week. One out of 30 is not a high percentage, right? So as you said, it does seem a bit, I mean, I teach on some of these things, you know, some of the sort of fallacies and that sort of thing and failures of logical thinking, I suppose. And you see those a lot in nutrition, and you've just highlighted one, probably the main one, right?
Yep. You just got to take that little switch in your brain and but change it. Just that dial.
Yeah. Any other sort of, so I suppose consistency is one, but in addition to consistency, are there any, you've seen a lot of nutrition and a lot of people doing probably very well and some people probably not doing so well. Are there any commonalities or what are the commonalities among people who tend to do, you know, very well and have, you know, 90% compliance or whatever it might be?
Planning ahead.
Okay.
Because, yeah, there's, you have the best of intentions. You show up to work and people bring in donuts, pizza, candy. Listen, you're hungry. You're dieting down. Like, yeah, whatever. You know, we're still wired for what? Tens of thousands of years ago, we're like, we just want to eat and we don't want to burn the fat because your body's like, no, you want to survive. So you got a plan though. You got some food already prepped for you. It's a lot easier to go in your head. Yeah. Okay. I would like some of those donuts. I'm really hungry. Oh, okay. I'm hungry. All right. Well, I'm just going to go eat that prepared meal I already have. And because it really just kind of changes your environment then, right? So, you know, willpower is cool, but it's pretty tough to just rely on that. So you have to set your environment up to be better. That usually is just a result of planning. So if you know you can't resist cookies when you're dieting, well, like, don't buy them or keep them somewhere else. It's easy. Like, I'll sometimes walk by my pantry. I've got two small kids. Like, we got snacks in there. I'll walk by and I see it and I'm like, yeah, actually I would like some Cheetos or whatever. It's like, if you don't, I mean, you see, you don't have to have them, right? Cause like, whatever, you got kids, whatever. Like, not everyone wants to eat like you. You don't have to force yourself on everyone else, but like, maybe just close the door or put it in a different shelf where it's not like right in your line of sight and you have to go out of your way to get to it. And if you do all that, there's just, and again, if you know a lot about habits, you know, that's just how you kind of break that cycle because things just tend to go automatic in our brain. So it's like, you just have to put a little resistance between the stuff that you don't want to do. And then the stuff that you do want to do, just try to make it a little bit easier.
It's a lot of the James Clear Atomic Habits type stuff, right? And it's also, people, I suppose, don't realize that willpower, it goes across domains, right? So like chipping away, if you're chipping away, you've had a tough day at work and then your nutrition, you know, is chipping away, it all degrades your willpower, right?
Yeah. Have a stressful day at work and then go try to, you know, stick to your diet. Good luck. It's going to be a lot harder. So you got to pick, you know, kind of, again, that's just planning though in my head, because would you want to plan a diet phase if like you're getting ready for a wedding or like going through final exams or something like that where you're super stressed out? No way. Your brain's like, eat, stress. Again, that willpower is just drained. So like, you just want to reach for the easiest thing, whatever's right in front of you. So again, it's just planning ahead, setting yourself up for better success.
One thing that I'm really interested in your opinion on, and we're a similar age, you know, probably mid-30s, is this trade-off, or if it is, you know, if it is indeed a trade-off between kind of nutrition for performance and nutrition for longevity. Now, you know, a lot of people, I think the pendulum swung a little bit back away from like fasting because most of the benefits, as I understand it, are from the caloric restriction rather than the sort of long period without eating. But how do you kind of think about this trade-off? Because obviously, you know, you're an IFBB pro bodybuilder, right? Or pro physique, like, that's a very high level of both performance and obviously physique. But do you think about things kind of differently in this sort of performance versus health and that sort of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, so fasting's great to help you eat less. That's kind of the main thing. But you can also just eat less if you eat more often too. It's just kind of pick your poison sort of thing. I would think that the one thing to longevity is that over time, you probably just want to be a little bit leaner and lighter. You know, when you're performance focused, whatever, you want to be a bodybuilder, you're not really concerned about that in terms of being lighter. Like, you want a bunch of muscle, and you know, by and large, muscle's okay, but there's all trade-offs. So, you know, if I get to a point where I'm like, yeah, longevity is just really my focus, yeah, I'm probably going to drop down under 200, like 215 right now. So, you know, 5'9", 190, sub 10% body fat, but yeah, I can go run a 5K, 10K. Like, that's probably better than being.
And that's still quite a lot of muscle. If you're lean at 190, yeah, at 5'9", that's still, people think that's small, but that's really not small.
Like, yeah, it's all relative.
Sure, I guess if you see IFBB pros and they're 280 pounds, whatever, but yeah, I get it. Okay, that's an interesting way, and I think, as you said, it's muscle within limits is going to be healthy, and just sort of maintaining performance as much as possible, right? Having this sort of hedge against inevitable decline. So there was one thing, and I think I've heard you talk about this on another podcast, that has sort of broader public health implications as well. And you probably know where I'm going with this, but dieting and the use of these GLP-1 agonists, right? So like semaglutide, people in the UK probably know that as Wegovy. You mentioned, I think, that you tried it for your last cut.
Yeah, and like I'm actually currently on it, yeah.
Interesting. So again, I'd love it if you sort of detailed, because you're not a guy who, you've proven that you can do it without that, right?
Yeah.
Like whether it's, I used to work at a body transformation gym, and like people would talk about the Diet Coke diet, and they do like 6 Diet Cokes a day to like help, you know, kill cravings a little bit and kill your appetite. But I mean, you're clearly a guy who's done it without. So I was wondering if you could kind of speak to, you know, dieting, and what people need to remember here is you weren't just dieting to get leaner. Like you're dieting for a physique show. So that is super, super lean, rather than, you know, like sub 8, sub 7, sub 6%, right? It's not sort of trying to look good at 10% or whatever. So just to preface it with that, you weren't using it to get to 10% or whatever, but how did you find the differences? And it, coming off it, how was that?
So I think, yeah, I've thought about this quite a bit, and I've definitely struggled like after a diet, just being really hungry and having some of those big weight spikes back in like maintenance and having a hard time with it and just really wanting to go all out on, you know, those like cheat meals and stuff like that. Here's the thing. I'm trying to think of a good analogy. It would be like you want to race somebody. You want to make it easier on yourself, not harder. So semaglutide, Wegovy, Ozempic, same thing, tirzepatide, Mounjaro, I think is what that's called. They're just tools to make it easier on dieting. Like it just enhances your ability to diet. Now, some people, like, they got the hunger signals that are just crazy, and they're going to have a really tough time ever dieting because of that. And I know people like that personally. So it takes that edge away. You know, when I said I was doing 15 to 20K steps a day and eating 1,800 calories a day, could I have done it without it? Yes, of course. Could I just gritted my teeth, and I've done that before, right? But man, that sucks, because you end and it's just like you rebound back up like crazy. So you just stay on it, and like that hunger doesn't come back as much. You're just able to easier maintain a lower body weight. For example, I'm actually using more now than I was during this last little diet that I did, because I'm experimenting around with it. And I was sort of scared to tweak the amounts up when I was actually dieting, but I'm like, you know what? I feel pretty good. So I'm using a little bit more now on maintenance. Dude, we got pizza on Saturday night. So it's Monday here that we're recording. And normally I'd be able to basically eat that entire pizza if I wanted to. It's like basically a meat lover's pizza with like stuffed crust, right? Amazing, amazing stuff. I had 3 pieces and I'm like, I'm done. I can't eat anything else. And I didn't want anything the rest of the night, which like normally, you know, I would come back and still had like, you know, protein shake or whatever or something like before bed. Like, no, nope. I had 1 piece the next day. And I could like barely eat my other clean meals. So it's like, it's just making it easier. I know there's a lot of people out there like, oh, that's cheating. Like, just use willpower. Yeah. Okay. Like, okay. I get it. I've done that. But it's just, it's like trying to be healthy, but without using, you know, modern medicine to like antibiotics. Okay. Maybe some people can get by without it because of whatever, why not just make it easier on ourselves, though, and use modern medicine? And then you're not fighting against yourself as much. You're just using it as a tool to help you out. That's really what it is. Now, again, it's a slippery slope, right? Because we probably know people that are using it and they're not weight training and they're maybe using too much, or like they don't have good habits in place anyways. Like there's a whole nother discussion there. But like from my perspective, I'm just using it because I've had those crazy rebounds and like where I just want to eat everything in sight and, you know, I'll go eat a whole pizza and you feel like crap. And then like all of a sudden your weight's up and it's just, I don't have that. So I'm going to use it. I'm going to kind of wean off of it slowly over time. And then like, lo and behold, you know, I was 225 when I started this diet. Now I'm 215. So maybe I'll do another little one. I'll get down under 210 and then I'll be able to hold at 210. It's just easier to do those things. So that's really where I'm coming from on that.
And would you use it purely like on maintenance phases as well? Like, are you in a kind of maintenance phase now? Or is it just like coming off the diet and going on the, you know?
Yes, I'm on maintenance right now. That's why I'm using it a little bit more, because this is where I would typically struggle, is more on maintenance. And so now it's like, it's not an issue. I'm maintaining my weight so easily now, because like I still get a little hungry, but like enough to eat all my normal meals. But like, yeah, that like urge to snack or go crazy overboard, it's not really there. I'm telling you, it's the difference between six pieces of pizza and like two or three. That's a big difference, because that's 1,500 calories probably between those.
Yeah. And it helps with other things as well. Like I think you mentioned, so one of the things I've struggled with, when trying to get rid of the lean was sleep, right? And like, it's really difficult. Like you have this fine balance between like, do you skew all your calories later in the day so you can kind of get to sleep? And then, you know, wake up starving at like 4 a.m. or do you eat more earlier in the day? Do you know what I mean? And you said that it actually helped with eliminating that. So, and that would make you just more effective overall, right? On everything.
Oh yeah, I slept way better on the prep going into becoming a pro, because I wasn't waking up at 4 a.m. hungry. Like I would wake up at 6 and then I'm like, okay, well, it's 6 o'clock. I'm cool to get up now and, you know, go do that. So yeah, it's just because I've done it the other way too. And it's just not fun. You wake up at like 3 or 4 in the morning. You just can't go back to sleep because you're hungry and your body's like, hey, dude, you should go eat. Well, like, well, I can't. And then what do? You can't really go back to sleep. Sometimes you get frustrated because you can't go back to sleep. It's just this weird kind of crappy cycle. So it's just, it's a tool that can make things easier. Like, why would you not want to use it if you can?
I totally agree. So kind of continuing on the nutrition theme, but going broader. So like you've helped a lot of people at RP and you've seen so many, must be millions, right? Or at least a million directly, and then way more with the YouTube channel and the podcast, etc. But we've got in the UK, and I know it's actually slightly worse in the US, you know, there's a real problem with obesity, right? There's a huge issue, and especially with childhood obesity and all those sorts of things. As someone who has a lot of kind of expertise in nutrition, but who also has a good understanding of not just sort of the elite fitness and performance stuff, but working with more kind of regular people, and, you know, you have young children. If you were, you know, president in the US, or like advising the president, like Arnold did, for example, right? And they came to you as a well-known fitness entrepreneur who's, you know, helped a lot of people. And, you know, it's Biden or whoever it is, right? And they said, you know, Nick, what could you do? Or what do you think the sort of two or three most useful public health things to help combat obesity? Is there any sort of things that spring to mind as a public health, rather than on the micro level, you know, the sort of macro level?
Man, that is a really hard question to answer.
That's a tough question, yeah.
And maybe try to give my best politician answer, right? Because in this, I'd be a politician. I don't know if I have exact answers, but like there's a couple of main underlying principles that we want to get to. And it's like, well, how can we just get kids being more active, doing something in general? So however we can encourage that, I don't know what the right answer is. I don't necessarily have the right answers. Cause you got people that grow up in totally different areas where like getting outside and doing stuff not as easy and or safe. So like there's a big hurdle there, but it goes back to the principle of how do we just get kids doing more in general activity not just sitting around playing video games. So like, I don't know if they can only stay inside. Like, I don't know. Can we get to a place where like VR is so affordable that they can do like fun stuff where they're up moving around? I don't know. Maybe I'm just throwing out examples here. Right. And, you know, how do we just make it, you know, when we go back to the habits, right, where that like junk food's not just right in your face. Well, right. So how do we maybe make it maybe a little bit tougher to get some of that stuff, and maybe make it a little bit easier to get some of the better stuff? Again, there's so much nuance involved there that it's really hard to.
There's clearly not a straightforward answer. Otherwise, someone would have given it already, right? It's clearly multifactorial and difficult.
So here's another thing too. Like sometimes people just don't want to do that stuff. All right. Well, can you force those people? No, that's not right. So there's a whole different ballgame of incentives, and then there's so much nuance to that. Like, I know that's not really a good answer, but gee whiz, I don't have a good answer because, yeah, if someone had a great answer, we'd probably all be doing it anyways.
Gonna say, yeah, nobody has a great answer, right? That's as good an answer as, yeah.
But maybe with technology upcoming and, you know, these like medical enhancements, right, where you can use some of these drugs, where like not being hungry is a complete game changer for a lot of people. Like there's a spectrum here of like not being hungry and being super hungry, just like genetics. I'm probably more on that hungry side, and then dieting kind of amplifies that even more. So like for me, I've seen it personally where like now I'm just fighting that less because of these like modern drugs that are, you know, helping. And by and large, like whatever, there might be some slight downsides, but probably overall the net benefit is beneficial. So like maybe there's a world in which like this is much more affordable and easy, because like you go around, like you want to go get metformin somewhere, you can get like a couple hundred tabs for like $3 or $4. So let's give it, you know, a few years where like it becomes very easy to get all that. Like you need Advil or something, like it's very cheap and affordable. So we're probably going to get to a spot before too long, or like who knows, with modern AI advancements and like gene therapy, gene editing, whatever, like who knows, maybe there's a pill that you can take that you'll just kind of be lighter anyways, and like maybe it'll solve itself. I don't know, right? So
no, I mean, it's, and they're all good points. I mean, I did a lot of my PhD on the sort of regulation of these things, so not the drugs themselves, but you know, it's with the GLP-1 agonists, right, these are early incarnations of it. In 10, 15 years time,
totally,
they could be even better, right? And that much more effective, like blood pressure pills and all sorts of stuff now, right?
Five years ago, none of this stuff existed, yeah.
Right, exactly. So, you know, as you said, with AI and all that sort of stuff and drug discovery like that, 10, 15 years, maybe the problem won't be so big. No, no pun intended.
I bet it won't be as big. If I was a betting man, then I would put my money on that, yeah.
So talking of projections, and I'm going to put you on the spot again here. You talked about just in about August last year. So, you know, way less than a year ago. I think you're at maybe like, we're changing gears a bit here. You're at maybe like 600,000 YouTube subscribers or something. And you said, oh, if we get to 1 million on YouTube, I'll get Mike a Lamborghini or something like that. But I was just wondering, it serves a couple of really interesting points here. But one, you know, what's next for RP given this incredible growth? So just for reference, I think you're at 1.64 or something million now. So
something like that, yeah.
Something huge and got to be one of the top few YouTube channels on health and fitness. What's, you know, what's next? Where do you go from here?
Yeah, it's amplifying the impact that we can have. So it's great to reach all these people, and it's, you know, certainly been very beneficial for RP overall. But now my mind is getting to another place of like, how can we use that? How can we give back? How can we do even more? So can we set up some RP research grants for, you know, labs around the world that are doing kinesiology related stuff? Because again, that's our niche. That's where we're going to have the impact, is in the fitness space. Can we set up some scholarships where like RP has more control over it? Because we have one now with the University of Michigan, but, and I love Michigan, but they kind of run the show. We don't have anything to do with it. And like when you go to a big university, most of the money that you put in, so let's say you put $100,000 in, 95% of that, 98% of that goes into the endowment fund. And you only kick off a little bit. So you're only able to give off a small fraction of it, which like, that's cool. I get it. That's like thinking long-term. You got to have the money in there to pay all the bills and all that stuff. Like, totally cool. No issues with that. But now it's to a point where, can we set up like a nonprofit? Can we do that? Where now we're giving back more, where, you know, people can apply and tell us their stories, and, you know, we give them money so they can go to school for kinesiology or, like, you know, health and fitness related fields. To me, that's like the next step for what we can do. Should be pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. And as you said, you're already doing quite a bit of that.
Yeah, it's just, you know, amplifying and doing even more.
Scholarships and that sort of thing. And I'm really glad you mentioned long-term, because this has kind of, it's triggered something in my head that I meant to ask you about. But you said, along with the internal locus of control, that people would be better served. And this goes as a theme throughout what we've been talking about for the last, you know, 45 minutes or whatever. But thinking about things in longer term time horizons, right? Not thinking about tomorrow, but thinking about, you know, next week, next month, next year. I was wondering if you could kind of, because that's clearly served you very well, right? Playing the long game and thinking about things in the long term. I was wondering if you kind of explain a bit more about that and about the thinking behind that.
Yeah. So you have to be able to think longer term, right? Because that's what gives you enough time to apply the slight edge and let the compound effect, the multiplier effect, kick in and do its thing.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of people have a hard time with that because people want to live in the here and now. And, like, I get it. And I do that delicate song and dance, that little trying to figure out what's best, because I've been way too far on the future focus. And then, like, I don't really enjoy living in the here and now. And then you're like, okay, maybe that's not the right approach. So it's a little bit of finding a balance. That, but yeah, if you want to be successful, like, you just have delayed gratification.
And there's a very persuasive, I know it's not your example, but a very persuasive example in the book, that I'll get you to kind of paraphrase now, but it's a marshmallow experiment by, sure, I think it's a guy called Michelle.
Walter Michelle. Yep.
Exactly. I was wondering if you kind of, cause that's such a good illustration of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, it's the idea of, like, you know, do you want one marshmallow now, or do you want two, whatever, in 15 minutes? And, you know, some kids were able to do it, some were. And then they studied those kids later on, and the kids that were able to delay it turned out being, you know, kind of better across the board. Now, was it a direct result of that? Yeah, you know, that part's a little up in the air, and people can debate on that. But what's really interesting is, like, the kids that were able to not, you just eat the marshmallow right away. Well, they usually were, like, distracting themselves or, like, doing something else. So they weren't focusing. They weren't focusing on the marshmallow. They put their focus somewhere else. That's a pretty interesting tidbit for me. It's like, all right, well, what can we learn from that? Right. Well, you don't put the junk food right in your eyesight, right? You do something else. You change your focus somewhere else. But yeah, it's really just, like, delayed gratification. They did a big study in, I think, New Zealand, where they, like, studied kids when they were, you know, young, and then they went back and, like, looked at their career and all that. And, like, well, the people that were, like, the most financially successful, the same people that, you know, answered all these questions when they were younger, that, like, they're able to basically control your impulse. It's impulse control. It's like, yeah, okay, well, I've got $100. Well, I can invest it and I'll have $200 later, or, you know, I can just spend $100 now and I can just have nice stuff. And it's like, all right, well, again, not everyone's going to do that, right? Because yeah, there's a whole thing on time horizons, and just some people are much more present focused, and they're like, I don't care about the future. Okay, well, it's interesting. But again, like, there's a reason not everyone's super successful, because it just, there's a whole bunch of variables that go into it. It's just, some people just don't give a shit about that. So it's like, all right.
Yeah. And as you said, I guess it's a balance between, you know, thinking long term and living in the present as well, right? Because obviously we don't know. Got to enjoy the present because, you know, it sounds all cliched, but that's, you know, what we know we have, right? Anything could happen. Hopefully it wouldn't. But, so one, kind of thing that I'd love to get your opinion on, we have this idea of sort of getting one piece of, like, and you've given so much good advice, but expert advice, you know, on a certain area. And you at RP talk a lot about these sort of pyramids, these hierarchies, right? And, like, hierarchies of need and that sort of thing. So I was wondering if you could kind of think about the hierarchy of needs when it comes to staying in really good shape with someone like you, right? You're a business owner. You've got two kids. You know, you have a demanding career. You have a demanding home life in a good way. But where do you sort of place the hierarchy of needs? Like, are there sort of five or three actionable steps to sort of how you can progressively take forward. I know you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, totally. What would be the most important? Well, most important is probably controlling your food intake, not just eating crazy amounts. So just eating mostly whole foods, not eating a lot of junk food. I feel like that is the true base, because nutrition kind of controls everything. Because even if you like exercise all the time, but you got a really bad diet, it's going to catch up with you sooner or later. So nutrition's got to be the base. Above that is going to be working out, like physical activity, making sure that you're training with weights a couple times a week. I would say that is level two. Level three would then be some type of cardio / like physical activity, getting in enough steps, whatever, you know, doing some cardio. If we want, I mean, theoretically you could have a pyramid right there with three things, but you know, there's probably something to be said for just like having enjoyable relationships with people and along with like just stress control, stress management, just not being freaked out all the time. And I used to be kind of like just crazy and would get really freaked out and stressed out about stuff, especially work related. And yeah, I just straight up just put a lot of work and effort into not being like that. And so now I just kind of view entrepreneurship as like, there's something else going to happen. I don't know what it is, but you know, it's just, what's the next thing? There's always something. So I'm not going to freak out about it. I'm just going to be, all right, well, what can we do about it? All right, well, let's do that.
What's the first thing you do when you wake up?
Unfortunately, I check my phone.
Okay, fair enough. I think a lot of people do.
Beyond that, actually, I go to YouTube and I look at the stats from the day before, because by the morning, by the time I wake up, they're all loaded from the day before. So usually I get a kick out of seeing that. And then I'll just look at some other like company metrics. I'm sick in the head, I know it, but that's the first thing I do.
Well, duties of a CEO, right? I guess in some ways.
I also like it. I enjoy it, so.
Well, it's a good start to the day for you. I mean, if you've got...
Hopefully. You know, most of the time it is, yes.
Most of the time, yeah. Okay, and I think I know the answer to this one, but what book has had the biggest influence on your approach to life?
Yeah, I mean, Slight Edge really is funny too, because I read Slight Edge after I wrote my own book. And I was like, holy crap, that really kind of put things together for me. You know, I've got like a list of probably like 10 or 15 main books that I really like. But that one's hard to beat, because it's just this... It's just this easy concept to grasp, but it's just so, so important.
How do you de-stress?
You know, sometimes it's hanging out with my wife and kids. Sometimes it's just kind of relaxing, watching a little TV at night. That's usually something my wife and I try to do, like after our kids go to bed. You know, it's a delicate balance, so we're not staying up too late, making sure we get to bed on time. But that's usually pretty relaxing. That's usually when I'll have my last meal of the day, some like casein and pretzels, some nuts, something like that. Sit down, watch a little TV with my wife.
Nice. One fitness myth you wish would die.
The consistency versus perfection, man. So people think they have to be so dialed in. You're like, man, you could be so much better off. You could relax. You could be de-stressed, right? By not having to be so perfect all the time.
And then, yeah, that's a great answer. And then these are related, and I think I know the answers, but what health or training goal are you currently focusing on?
So Dr. Mike's going to compete this summer. Jared's going to be up there too. So we're actually going to do an RP photo shoot. So yeah, about 4, 5, 6 weeks out than that, I'll do a little mini cut into that. But right now I'm just maintaining, and it's great, man. Maintenance is cool, especially as we talked about with semaglutide. Like, I don't have crazy cravings. I can eat all my normal healthy food. I'm able to maintain a super easy weight, getting in just a lot of steps from, you know, it's pretty nice weather here in the U.S. right now, kind of late spring. So, yeah, just chilling for a little bit more, and then I'll get after it a little bit this summer.
And I'm going to flag up that you did an excellent podcast on this very subject, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Any tips for maintaining training while traveling?
Yeah, it just goes back to like just a little something. And then the idea is like, you don't need as much as you think you do, especially after you've been training for a while. Consistency is more important than perfection. I know that just sounds lame because we've been talking about that so much, but it really is truth. When you put it into practice, you're like, oh, okay. Well, yeah, I can't train 6 times a week, but guess what? I'm traveling. I can get in 3 workouts this week. And yeah, it's not ideal, but the amount that you need to maintain is pretty small. So you cut things in half and it's like no big deal, especially if it's just a week. Or just get back on it, right? You're never more than the next week from being right back on track.
No, that's such a good point. And we actually had Dr. Packard not long ago. So
minimum
effective dose,
that's
right?
That's his MO, man. Yeah.
And then, right, last few. What's the most valuable lesson you've learned as an entrepreneur?
Oh, I think what I said earlier, there's always going to be something that pops up. Just remain calm, cool, and collected. Just be unfazed. Shit's going to happen. Just
And I think you've just answered the next question very well without trying. But how would you describe your leadership style in three words?
Calm, cool, collected. Absolutely. You want to go back to, mantras, whatever you want to call it, affirmations. Like, I tell myself that every single day. And again, I say that because I did not used to be like that, but it is something you can sort of learn and train yourself on over time. Hopefully my wife would say that now too, or she would not have said that, a while ago. And so it's really important, man, because it all kind of starts with that. Because if you can control your emotions, you not get rattled by stuff. Because like, what happens when you get rattled, right? You're more likely to make bad decisions.
Yeah, it's like making bad decisions, if you're tired or you're hungry any of that stuff, right?
Emotions can lead to very bad decisions.
Totally. And you guys do a lot with kind of tech stuff, with the apps especially, and AI and that sort of thing, right? So if you could invest in any, I'm going to say other, any health tech kind of startup, what sector would it be in?
Something to do with robotics.
Cool. Yeah, there's so many Boston Robotics and stuff. Yeah, there's some pretty amazing stuff there. Last couple, and I think I know the answer to this one, but is there one book you'd recommend to anyone starting their own business?
Man, books are a really hard thing to recommend because I swear, like, sometimes you just have to read them in the right kind of time or right frame of mind. For like entrepreneurs, there'd be, I'm just going to say 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. There's a lot of good stuff in that.
And last one, and you've talked about this as well already, but what would you like your legacy to be? So, you work for another 35 years and you finally retire. RP's taken over the world. What's Nick Shaw's legacy?
Man, that they helped millions of people get in better shape. And if you get in better shape, if you're healthy, it just leads to so many good outcomes. Because like when you're healthy and you're in good shape, like you just feel better. I'm speaking in generalities here and averages, but you feel better. You probably treat people better. You're just happier because you're up and moving around. Like there's just a lot more to it. So how can we make the world a better place? Like at RP, we're going to do that through fitness. And again, it's not the same as, other companies that are doing other great, fantastic things, but like, we just know who we are and that's our niche and that's what we're going to do. So it's like, how can we help as many people as we can in the fitness space, not fall victim to all these silly stuff? Just, hey, here's the stuff that works. Just do this. If you can, you'll get great results. And there you go.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.